Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Turning Towards Life. I'm Lizzie, and this is also Justin here. We are here every week, every Sunday, and it's a great joy that we get to do this with you and together with one another. Every week, one of us chooses a source, and that determines who says hello and who says goodbye. You might have worked out the formula by now. And if you've only started listening, you may not have listen to the episode where I figured that out. I always thought Justin was really, really clever and that he knew that there was this formula that you had to follow. And then he said, no, it's just like whoever brings the sauce, the opposite one says hello. And it was very revelatory to me. So anyway, you may have noticed the formula. So it's I'm saying hello this week and Justin's chosen the sauce. And as always, Justin, I'm so amazed by the range of your sauce choice. And I don't know who Taylor Marley is. And I'm thinking, I need to know who Taylor Marley is. And through Taylor's work, we're going to learn. And that's what happens every week. I sit here and I learn and I open and I wonder and get taught in the moment about life and deepening and what on earth it is to be human. So I'm super, super grateful to be here as always. And thank you, Justin, for your kind of openness that receives this huge range of sources for to bring here. It's really wonderful.
Well, thank you, Lizzie. Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm really struck by something you just said, which I don't think either of us have ever said by way of introduction to a Turning Towards Life in all the 251 now that we've done, which is that what we're doing is learning together. And it's so obvious now you say it that that's what we're doing, that a source comes in and we learn from it and we learn from one another. And then we're alongside many, 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 many people. So all of you who are with us are learning with us. And I'm really excited to talk about it that way and also to feel what the cumulative collective learning that happens because we're all in this together. It's certainly way beyond you and me, Lizzie. And I know that many people share these conversations with other people that they know and love when they feel maybe that there's something to learn on in the midst of the conversation that would be of benefit to them. So you're very welcome to do that, everyone. And I don't think we've said this for a while. We have a this project comes out of Third Space. You can find us Third Space at wearethirdspace.org, and we have a website turningtowards.life, which has got all the previous 250 conversations on, and you can sign up there to get the conversation each week emailed to you with the source and the video. And we're on podcasts and all of those kind of places. So this source, Taylor Marley, I have not got a clue how this came to me. I was rooting through the collection of sources that I have, and here it was, and it seemed like his work was right for now. And I don't know how I found it. Probably somebody told me. So thank you to whoever you are who brought this our way that we don't remember. What a gift. And so we'll do as we ordinarily do is we'll read it and then we'll talk. And you can always find the sources on the website, in the emails, in the podcasts, on YouTube, all of those places. And it's called Magnifies an Object 10 Times. Magnifies an object 10 times is what it clearly said on the handle of the magnifying glass my father received on his fifth birthday. He took it as a warning. The birthday gift would only work its magic 10 times and no more, becoming after that just a small round window with no miracle, toy giant's monocle, a circle of simple glass. And so he went about his days with curious thrift, weighing how much he needed to see any part of the world up close, observing as best he could with his own eyes first, thinking, do I need to see that dead bug big, that dandelion, that blade of grass, that wriggling moth in the spider's web? I can imagine most of nature's gifts and crimes, best not to waste one of my 10 precious times. He lost count of how many miracles he'd left, and for weeks after, half expected the magic of the glass to simply stop. And I have asked him to tell me of the thrilling moment he realized, or was told, 10 times in this context simply meant tenfold, and not 10 instances, but he cannot remember. Likewise, the joy that must have come with such a limitless epiphany. But what he does recall and says he most misses still is the way the magic made him see the world the rest of the time. Not through the glass, but all the time he thought that magic would not last.
Magnifies an object 10 times is what it clearly said on the handle of the magnifying glass my father received on his 5th birthday. He took it as a warning. The birthday gift would only work its magic 10 times and no more, becoming after that just a small round window with no miracle, toy giant's monocle, a circle of simple glass. And so he went about his days with curious thrift, weighing how much he needed to see any part of the world up close, observing as best he could with his own eyes first, thinking, do I need to see that dead bug big, that dandelion, that blade of grass, that wriggling moth in the spider's web? I can imagine most of nature's gifts and crimes. Best not to waste one of my 10 precious times. He lost count of how many miracles he had left, and for weeks after, half expected the magic of the glass to simply stop. And I've asked him to tell me if the thrilling moment he realised or was told 10 times in this context simply meant tenfold and not 10 instances, but he cannot remember. Likewise, the joy that must have come with such a limitless epiphany. But what he does recall and says most he misses still is the way the magic made him see the world the rest of the time. Not through the glass, but all the time he thought that magic would not last.
This makes me smile from my head to my toes. And I think the first thing that's here, just in hearing myself read it and then hearing you read it back, is not actually the content. It's the joy of storytelling. It's the joy of recounting to one another what happened and what it meant. And obviously Taylor Mullen has done an amazing job of crafting this in a way that's so inviting, so joyful and so wondrous, and though the language is so captivating. But it's, I feel like it's reawakening in me, or sort of reconnecting me with the joy of actually of what we're doing in this conversation, what we do, which is talking to one another about our experience, about what we see, and what a huge gift it is just to share with one another our experience of being human, which is so different to a lot of other conversations we might have, particularly the conversations about all the things we have to do and when they have to be done by, and you know, all the things in the world that are pressing that we have to solve, which we do, all of that, they all really matter. And somehow a story about a magnifying glass told with generosity is so moving and so heartwarming and so enlivening. So I'm really enjoying that. So since I read this, one of the things I've been doing is taking up the practice of treating people, situations, experiences as if there were only 10, as if I had to really, really, really pay attention to them, as if they wouldn't last. And it's true that they won't. And that's been, has not been at all upsetting for actually for me to do. It's been really, really joyful, and it's helped me enormously sort of undo. There's a level in me that's very easy to happen, a sort of like a something that happens in me which can, I don't know, distance me from the experience of being in my life, make things ordinary and humdrum and routine, or just have me not feel very much about what I'm in the middle of. So when I walked out the door this morning to go somewhere and I said goodbye to Davina to go, I practiced going, I wonder how many times I'll get to do this again. When I went for a swim in the pond this morning, I practiced swimming as if it was the last time I would swim, which it might be. It could well be. None of us ever know. And I can feel the way that something that this poem really touches into, which is that when we treat experiences, I've been doing it with washing the dishes and making the bed and ordinary, really ordinary things, like how I would miss being able to make the bed if I couldn't make the bed, even though it's always like probably I wish I was doing something else in that moment because there's something more interesting to do. But also how it's making me, I love this thing in the poem where he goes, maybe I won't look through the glass now because I'll have to look with my own eyes because I can't use the glass every time. I'm going to have to imagine. It's also really helping me to look at the ordinary life and to go, what if I look? What if I do the, oh, so hard to find the right way to say this. Like I look as if there's magic and miracle right in the thing that I'm doing that I could see if I had the right instrument, but I don't need the instrument to see it because I'm going to look in such a way as if it were there anyway. Because if I did use the instrument, I'd only have 10 times that bit. That way of seeing, it's really helping with sort of feeling the awe and wonder of very, 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 very ordinary ordinariness. I'm really very grateful for that.
Funny, as you're speaking, Justin, some other, I don't know, maybe this is saying the same thing. I can't quite figure it out. But the line for me that really hits me is, do I need to see that dead bug big? And I think what happens for me is like I recognize in myself that there's a kind of wanting to make things more intense or more alive than I might think that or might be perceiving that they are. Oh gosh, it's like on the edge of my ability to say. But I feel like that question, do I really need to see this dead bug big? It's like, can this be enough just the way that it is without me trying to crank it up to something that I think would be more exciting or more enlivening or more like, we just went away somewhere for a week. And I noticed that I have quite a big reaction to like maximizing a holiday or something, or maximizing an experience with someone or something that seems precious that you've planned or that you like that I've looked forward to for a while or something. It's like I then have to go, well, okay, now this has got to be the thing I thought it was going to be. How is this going to live up to my expectation or something? And I feel like this is asking me to kind of not like to become aware of that need and examine what's behind it so that I can actually be somewhere. I can actually be, like you're saying, in the preciousness of something completely ordinary without trying to make something better or bigger or more lovely, or like how do I be in life in like a simple way that's just, oh, look at that bug. Like I don't need to like zoom in on the bug and then dissect the bug and make the bug all of my life. Although that must, you know, that's also cool. It's like I feel like I'm being invited into wondering what it is to let life be enough right now, just as it is, without trying to ham it up, without trying to maximize, without trying to intensify or make more brilliant with some mechanism that I seem to think exists in me, which probably doesn't, probably always ends in tears if I try and do that. But I have that. I have that really strongly of like, we have to get up early because we have to go to the. It's like, really, do I? It's so good that this is like a wedge in a pattern of mine, basically. This is like a kind of, hold on a second, Lizzie. Do you really have to try and make that bigger than it is right now? And no, because it's just as beautiful the way that it is, rather than me trying to make it into something.
I love that. So that's, I get it, and that's where the two sides of this poem really come together. Like it's really, really precious to look through the glass when sometimes we're called to look through the glass and something that was very little goes whoosh, like because we're really seeing something we wouldn't otherwise see. But a lot of the time it's not necessary. And But not only that it's not necessary, because that's not really the right way of talking about it at all. What I heard in what you're saying is that there's a cost to like bigging everything up all the time, every experience, to amplify, to having to sort of amplify every experience. And what happened with me when we were talking, I was thinking, well, one of the troubles that we have is pretty much everything in the culture around us still tells us that we ought to maximize. You know, like maximize that holiday, maximize that train ride, maximize that friendship, maximize that relationship, maximize, you know, that date, maximize that meal. Like somehow it would only be real if you were squeezing every drop of juice out of it, which it's not like we're saying, it's not that that's not sometimes the thing to do, to really enter into something like really fully and to really like but it turns out to be a very problematic way to live, mostly, I mean, for two reasons I can feel immediately, mostly because of the kind of demand it places on us to live. This phrase that's got getting really on my nerves at the moment about living your best life. Like, I'm living my best life, but except most of us feel all the time that we're not, because it could be so much more exciting or so much more vibrant or so much more grand, or I could feel so much more love, or I could. So there's a real setup there of sort of like the distance between. But the other thing is, the really curious thing about it that's very present for me and what you said in noticing your own pattern, and boy, do I have. You know, lots of my own stories of particularly trips or times with friends. Like a dear friend from America who I hadn't seen came over after 20 years, and I could feel that we were both doing that. We've got to make this really good, and if it's not really good, it's going to be a disappointment. And it wasn't really good; it was a bit of a disappointment. But actually not, because it was a miracle that we, who had been friends when we were seven, could be in the same place when we were 51 and have a conversation and find out about one another's lives and look one another in the eye. And it wasn't like being seven, and it wasn't like anything we'd imagined, and it wasn't like any of the sort of big expectations we had for how, you know, it was ordinary. It's actually an absolute tragedy that we have, so many of us, lost sight of how absolutely miraculous the ordinary that is, like the ordinariness of having a body and having and being conscious and being and having free will and being able to love and being able to wash the dishes and being able to have a cup of tea and being able to sweep the floor and be they are actually all of them miraculous, and every single one of them. Even the most ordinary things in our lives took millions of years of learning and creating and inventing and relating, you know, just to have a building that you can be in and tools to something to wipe the surface. And, you know, and it can't, I think what we're doing in this conversation is not trying to collapse into one or other end of this sort of polarity of like, and of course, there's looking at the dandelion through the magnifying glass and seeing how mind-blowingly magnificent it is up close. But there's also the cost that comes to us of not inhabiting the absolutely sacred ordinary, the extraordinary ordinary. That costs us so much and keeps us going at such a pace. So I'm really sort of feeling both the joy of the ordinary, but also sort of like the pain of what it is to not be able to be at home right where we are.
And I think this line as well, most of all, he misses the way the magic made him see the world the rest of the time. And that for me links back to how his imagination works. I think I can imagine most of nature's gifts and crimes. Like, to let our imaginations have validity, to let them be real. You know, we've had this conversation a few times, Justin, about our kind of inner work and the stories that come when we ask ourselves and we inquire, and part of our cynical self says, oh, well, is that even real? Did I just make that up? And even if we did make it up, it's in our imagination, and our imagination has gift in it. Like we can imagine a story about something, and it's a story. It has the weight of a story. And how beautiful is that? And so I feel also this is a, well, this is also that from the perspective retrospectively of a 5-year-old, and that part of us that can imagine, that part of us that can remember things like a magnifying glass and let the stories from that place have life now. And clearly this person's 5-year-old self story means the world to Taylor, who's this person's son. And it feels like in itself it has power because of the story that got told about it. So I'm feeling the value of our imagination, the value of the stories that we live, that then they get told. And inside of that telling, goodness knows what eruptions in other people's imagination happen. So I'm feeling the gift of that, and how, you know, I suppose because I also live with a 2-year-old at the moment, and she has, oh, I have to tell you the saying, the thing she said today, Justin. I think it's in these realms because she's in the imaginal worlds. And she said to my sister earlier, she said, today is my day, and you and anyone can come if you like. I thought, my goodness, what a something to live by. Today is my day, and you and anyone can come if you like. It's the same realms. It's like goodness knows what she's imagining her day is. But what an invitation for us all to go to pay attention to what our imaginations that mostly have been completely flattened in whatever systems we've been in, and adulthood and mortgages and taking things all very seriously. This whole, like you said at the very beginning, Justin, the way that this is written and the joy that arises, the freedom, the part of you, the part of me that gets kind of awakened, which is this, I can remember what it's like to read a label and then it turns out it means something completely different because I've been literal about it, and it's not that. So I can feel this like awakening up in me of imaginal things and my imagined life. And lives. And what a gift it is to feel that kind of frivolous, joyful childlikeness about life. And I think that's why this is so moving, because it speaks to a part of me that needs life, that needs to be present, that has all kinds of wisdom, that allows me to live in a way that has lightness in it rather than the kind of plodding alongness with the difficult things that life can become. It feels so enlivening and sparky and interesting. And I can feel my curiosity about dandelions, blades of grass, and wriggling moths coming to life through being in this conversation with you.
Love what you're saying about imagination and hearing you talk about Vesper, what Vesper can see today, and you, and feeling what this poem does is having me feel again that maybe imagination is everything. If we're going to live a life, we have to really live it with imagination. I mean, that's partly what it takes to not have life be humdrum. I think that this sort of this really curious combination of things in our culture which go, I think one thing in the wider culture that many of us in goes, life is meaningless and flat and explainable in very ordinary terms. It's all physics, or it's all maths, or it's all stuff. There's nothing else. And we're a bit of a freaky accident in the middle of that, or something. Plus, the way many of us had our imagination squished out of us in the education that we received, which told us that imagination was for only for those times that you were writing an English essay or doing a bit of art or something. But once you got down to the really serious things, you'd stop doing that and you'd get real and practical. Those are just two of the sort of the pressures on us which have got us out of contact with our imaginations. And to lie in the grass and to imagine what might be going on with this dandelion, or to look into the eyes of somebody and to imagine, what happens if I look at you as I'm doing now and imagine your preciousness and your extraordinariness and your mystery. I can imagine, and you come to life. You're already very alive in me, but I can feel it now, how that's you come to life in ways that doesn't. It's not the same as trying to squeeze the every bit of juice out of the experience that we were talking about before. It's more like, look, Lizzie's right here. My goodness, I can let myself imagine the possibilities of that. I've also been thinking about the curious thing. I think what's happened for many of us is that our imaginations got replaced by entertainment. So because we were told that our imagination, we learned not to really exercise our imaginations, and we feel the emptiness, the bereftness of it. And so what we do is we try to fill that space by ever more intense kinds of entertainment. And entertainment can be wonderful. Of course it can. But noticing that what we do is we abandon our own imagination in order to have it filled by the latest music that's out, or the latest TV show, or the latest film, or the latest, experience. To have lost contact with the ordinary, everyday magic of being able to go, today is my day, and everyone's invited, and to live that way, and to sort of live imaginatively in stories. Like, there are so many better stories than many of the ones we often end up living with. And actually, the shifting the story can have something as ordinary as mopping the kitchen floor start to come forward in. It's a whole new sort of part of a, or learning something, or eating a meal, or preparing a meal, or going for a walk, or. So I'm feeling sort of very resonant with those possibilities from our conversation, and they're very joyful. I think in the way that when I hear this poem, I go, that's what's so exciting about it.
Yeah, Justin, it's reminding me when my granddad died a few years ago, we all went to look at all of the things in his house and throw some things away and keep things and whatever, and I ended up with a bunch of letters. And one of the bunches of letters was between my dad and his brother, and my dad's brother died when they were older than these letters. So they were about, I think, probably like 7 and 9 or something when these letters got written. And then my dad and his brother, he also had a younger brother too, but the two older ones were closer in age. And they grew up. And then my dad's brother died when he was around 17, and my dad was about 15. And so these letters are particularly kind of meaningful because they came from a place that was about their real kind of brotherly connection when they were really little. And the letters were when my dad's older brother had gone away for the first time and stayed in a kind of campsite or something a few hours away in a coach, and my dad was at home. And my dad, these letters were from my dad to his brother about what was happening at home while he was away. And it was in the days when obviously there wasn't any phone calls or anything like that. It was They wrote letters to one another, even in a kind of few day camping trip. Anyway, my dad wrote to his brother, and he wrote to him about a snail that was in the garden that he'd found in the shed. And it was this like 3-page letter of really sweet handwriting of everything that had happened with the snail. And it was such a sweet letter that involved the neighbors and what had happened when they picked the snail up and what the snail's name was. And all it was like a whole world was made because of the snail, and it was a kind of reason and a way to connect and to share with his brother as well, because obviously if he'd been at home they would have been in the snail drama together, kind of thing. And also just one of the sweet details of it was that he'd signed his name. So my dad's called Tony, and obviously the nickname that his older brother had for him was Toenails, and he'd signed the letter Love from Toenails. And just that all of that like brings so much beauty to life, like the beauty that exists in there, the relationship, the warmth and the play, and the when the small world of a snail is the biggest thing, and the nicknames we call one another, and the kind of sweetness that exists between human beings, that very many times is only when we're little. But what? But I don't know that it has to be that way. You know, like transporting that sweetness, that playfulness from our littleness into our bigness feels like the most meaningful, human, wonderful possibility to me, that we can transport our small selves along with us all the way and let that still be fully intact and call each other toenails and make things up and tell stories to one another and let our imaginative lives live between us, as well as being these responsible people with things that we have to do. And of course, there's those realities too, but I don't think those things are more real than the realities of toenails and snails and sweet letters about a whole world that a snail made in the garden and on the shed kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. I'm really with you. It's not holding on to being staying as children, because there are things to take care of in the world that need our adulthood and our dignity and our capacity and our wisdom and everything. But the story that we have of adulthood, which is that we should lose our imagination and lose our playfulness and lose our kind of sense of radical amazement at the snail in the garden and having a brother to talk to, and that's the thing, that the being able to inhabit the wonder and mystery and playfulness of a life that we frankly have no, really very few bearings and very, very rarely really know what to do, instead of taking that as like a reason to really sort of flatten ourselves. I think you said talked about flattening our imagination earlier. Instead of flattening ourselves, maybe we could live into our lives as an invitation to be ever more imaginative, playful, in radical wonder at what's here. And that might have us less having to chase things that aren't going to fulfill us anyway. All the things that we imagine will one day, when I will then feel fulfilled, we might get to live in the wonder and amazement of being here at all much more often than we do. That's how it feels to me to be in this conversation. I feel really filled with wonder and amazement, and I think that's one of the things that's been at the heart of this practice together. I'm so grateful to you, Lizzie, for bringing that and being that, and us getting a chance to be each week to spend some time in wonder and amazement and playful reciprocity around things that are also deep and matter, you know, around what matters. It's a great privilege. So we are at our time. So, Lizzie, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for being with us. We're so glad that we get to do this alongside you, and people keep on telling us how these conversations matter to them. So thank you, everyone, for having this matter to you. And it matters to us too. And all being well, we will see you next week.
Hi, everyone.
Bye, everyone.